naked face on the alley cinders, his arms and hands trailing palms up. The boy, who was left-handed, swung away from James and swung his arm back to stab Clarence King in the side. Henry James had written William just before Christmas that he'd been putting on far too much weight, that he was going forth belly first into the world these days, and it did not please him. He told William how he'd hired a fencing coach for 3 2-hour workouts a week, but also how, while James very much enjoyed the exercise, it hadn't taken an ounce off his weight. Now James raised his own walking stick and brought it down on the boy's wrist as if he were driving a tent peg with a mallet. Surprisingly, his aim was perfect. He heard the head of the cane make loud contact with the scrawny young thug's wrist bone, and the knife dropped to the alley cinders. The young thug shouted in pain, but he was very, very fast. He dropped to one knee to retrieve the knife before James could even get his cane raised again. King stepped forward and planted his polished but heavy boot on the knife blade. The young thug tugged, but the blade snapped off at the hilt.
"Trade knife," said Roosevelt from where he stood astride the fallen leader. "They give them away to the Indians by the gross out in the Badlands. Not worth a damn."
King had shifted his cane to his left hand, and suddenly from a coat pocket he pulled out a jackknife which he flicked open with a snap of his wrist. The blade was enormous for a folding knife, at least 7 inches long, James thought, and tapered to a terrifying point. King set that sharpened point a millimeter under the young thug's left eye, pushing strongly enough to draw blood and a terrified gasp from the would-be highwayman. James half expected King to pop the boy's eye out like a street vendor scooping out ice cream on a hot summer night.
"There's a lesson here, boy," hissed King. "If you're coming to a knife fight, bring a knife. Otherwise, you'll end up with a Heidelberg scar."
King flicked the blade right across the young thug's cheek, and blood geysered. The boy screamed, clasped both hands to his open cheek to hold together the bloody flaps now exposing his molars, stood, and ran off into the night. James could only stare at the two men unconscious on the ground as the sound of the boy's pounding boots dwindled down the dark alleyway. He jumped slightly when someone touched his elbow, but it was only Roosevelt.
"That move of yours was rather neat, Mr. James." "Very neat, I thought," said King, cleaning off the stone head of his cane and the dirt and cinders. "Your right sleeve is ripped and bloody," said young Theodore. "Did that young brat do that?"
"No," said James, astounded at how steady his voice sounded. "I fell when getting off a trolley a short while ago. Just tore it up a bit on the gravel."
King and Roosevelt exchanged a glance, but said nothing. They stepped away from the two forms on the ground, one moaning and weeping, the other still unconscious. King twirled his newly cleaned cane.
"We really were headed for Hayes' place for dinner. Would you care to accompany us, Mr. James?"
"I would, Mr. King," said the writer.
2 blocks further, where the streetlights were closer together, shops were open, the street was evenly paved, and the true sidewalks began again, they saw a cab passing that was large enough for the three of them, and Roosevelt hailed it with a whistle that made the horse jump. 15. The Panic of 93. Most of the dinner guests had not yet arrived when Roosevelt, King, and James knocked on the door, but Hay immediately took in Harry's dishabille and told his head butler Benson and another servant named Napier to help Mr. James up to his room. Dr. Granger, who'd arrived early just so that he could have a whiskey and quiet conversation with his old friend Hay, looked at James's sleeve and said,
"I'd best come up to your room with you and have a look at that."
"It's nothing," said James. "I'll just get my bag from John's man," said the doctor.
Roosevelt, wearing his pince-nez again, grinned and said,
"Dr. Granger brings his medical bag to social occasions?" "Dr. Granger brings his medical bag everywhere he goes," said Clarence King.
Upstairs, James kicked off his spats first, and when Napier swept them up and said,
"I'll have these cleaned immediately, sir,"
James snapped,
"No, burn them."
He would always see the contemptuous stain on the one spat, no matter how clean it might be.
"Come into the bathroom where it's bright," ordered Dr. Granger. Imagine, a guest room with its own bathroom, running water, and electric lights. Will wonders never cease?
The sumptuous bathroom was as bright and sterile as a surgical operating room, and when James had removed his sodden and torn shirt and thrown it in a corner, Dr. Granger looked at the lacerated forearm and said,
"How did you say you injured your arm?"
"Jumping off a trolley a bit too soon and falling on cinders," James said, having to avert his gaze even as he spoke.
Granger's blue eyes could sometimes be as playful as Teddy Roosevelt's, and he only gave James a glance before saying,
"All right, but this particular bit of street or alley appears to have been paved with birdshot."
Napier had brought a small, curved white pan, and Dr. Granger used some sort of tong-like instrument to remove the shotgun pellets one by one, each clanking as the round bit of shot dropped into the pan, making James blush yet again. Dr. Granger removed 12 of the pellets and put iodine, or something equally as painful, over the extraction cuts and other lacerations where there had been no shot.
"None touched muscle," said Dr. Granger. "Most barely penetrated the skin. If I didn't know better, I'd swear you'd been in a slight hunting accident, suffering from a shotgun fired from some distance."
"I don't hunt, sir," said James.
He started to pull on the clean white dress shirt Benson had brought from the wardrobe.
"Just a minute," said Dr. Granger. "You don't want to get iodine stains all over your shirt sleeve, and I don't want those wounds to get infected. Hold your arm steady, there, against the wash basin."
Granger removed a roll of bandage and some scissors from his bag, and within a minute, James's entire forearm had been carefully wrapped and taped.
"Feel any better?" asked Dr. Granger.
"I feel like a fool, and,"
he gestured with the right arm bandaged almost to his elbow,
"like an Egyptian mummy."
"Wait, don't put on the shirt quite yet," said the doctor.
He was filling a syringe with a dark fluid from a vial.
"Wait, I don't think," began James,
but the doctor had already administered the injection in the author's upper arm.
"What was that?"
"Just a little something to help with the pain and to cut down on the chance of tetanus," said the doctor as he closed the bag.
Damn, thought James.
He'd recognized the morphine and should have spoken sooner. Both he and Catherine Loring had been trained in how to administer the liberal doses of morphine to his sister Alice in her last months of dying. She'd actually passed away while lost in her morphine dreams, and Henry James had vowed never to allow anyone to put the stuff in his own veins.
Too late.
And the pain was less, much less. James thought of Sherlock Holmes and his abominable injections, and wondered if this light feeling, almost of happiness, might be the result of those illicit injections as well.
"If I babble like an idiot during dinner," said James, "I shall blame it on you and your needle, Dr. Granger."
"If we're not all babbling like idiots by the third course," said the doctor, "we shall have to blame it on Hay for not providing sufficient wine and liquor."
As the other guests were arriving, and just before they repaired to the dining room, Hay saw that James was concerned about something. He gingerly took the author's left upper arm, led him to the hallway, and said,
"What's wrong, Harry? Can I help?"
James realized that he was biting his lip.
"Absurd as it sounds, John," he said softly, "I find that I simply must get in touch with Mr. Holmes. It's urgent."
"Sherlock Holmes?" said his host. "I thought he'd left town."
"Perhaps he has," said James, "but I really must communicate something to him. He did leave the address of a cigar store here in town, so if perhaps your man could find a boy to carry a message."
"We can do better than that, Harry.
We can see if the cigar store has a telephone and contact them directly.
Why on earth would a cigar store have a telephone? Said James.
He fought down another uncharacteristic urge to giggle aloud. Hay shrugged as he led the way to his private study.
Strange age we live in, Harry.
James had noticed the telephone in Hay's study before, but he'd never seen his host operate it. Now there were several minutes back and forth with someone James understood to be an operator, or perhaps general information person. And then Hay grinned, handed the apparatus to James, and said,
Mr. Twill is on the phone. He's the manager of the cigar store Holmes mentioned, and he's there now.
Hay left the room so that James could have privacy.
Hello? Hello? Hello?
Said James, feeling rather idiotic. When he and Mr. Twill had both identified themselves again, James said,
I understand that someone at your store receives and conveys messages to Mr. Sherlock Holmes. It is absolutely imperative, urgently imperative, that I get in touch with him at once, or speak to him telephonically if he is there now.
Mr. Sherlock Holmes, sir?
Squawked Twill's voice through the rumble and scratching of the phone lines.
Yes.
English gentleman, sir?
That's him.
No, he hasn't been around the store, sir, since the day he paid me for this little service of sending along messages. He has a boy come check 2 or 3 times a day.
James sighed. If he didn't feel so light at the moment, he realized that his chest would be aching with anxiety at giving Holmes the extraordinary news of what he had seen and heard that afternoon.
All right, he said. Could you please take down this message and get it to Mr. Holmes as quickly as possible?
As soon as his boy stops by, sir.
All right. The message reads, have you paper and pen ready?
Pencil poised, sir.
The message reads,
James had to pause a second to frame it.
I followed Professor Moriarty to a meeting here in Washington today. I overheard. Yes. Yes, I'll slow down.
You can go ahead now, sir. You overheard?
I overheard Moriarty sharing his plans about May 1st with several groups. It's absolutely imperative that you contact me at once. I leave by train tomorrow, that's Sunday, 9 April, afternoon. Absolutely urgent that we speak before then. Signed, James. Can you read that back to me, please?
Twill did so. James corrected a couple of minor infelicities in the cigar store keeper's notes, and then the line was dead, and the author was fumbling to hang the hearing apparatus onto the speaking stem and then to get the whole contraption back on its shelf. Perhaps it was the morphine, if it had been morphine, but the evening's dinner party was one of the most enjoyable Henry James could ever recall. James could not stop laughing. The day's events should have been hanging over him like a black shroud, but instead the sharp memories of hiding on the high beam, of Moriarty, of the criminals and anarchists, and of the street confrontation with the ruffians, a bloody confrontation of which neither Teddy Roosevelt nor Clarence King showed the slightest signs, either in manner or spatters of this or that on their formal clothing, seemed to buoy James up with a joy and energy he'd not felt for years. He was wearing a fresh shirt and dinner jacket. Hay sat at one end of the table again, overseeing the conversation and stimulating it when it lagged, which it almost never did with this all-male group. James was given pride of place to the right of their host, and to his right was his old acquaintance Rudyard Kipling. James had given away the bride, Miss Carrie Ballastier, at Kipling's 1892 wedding in London, and, to complete the bonds of affection, the two men were mutual literary admirers. Why Kipling, who represented so much about Britain, proud and shameful, in his writing, chose to live in America was beyond James's comprehension. Henry Adams sat next to Kipling, and beyond him was Teddy Roosevelt. This night, Augustus St. Gaudens took the chair at the opposite end of the table from John Hay. James admired St. Gaudens's sculpture almost beyond words with which to praise it. He thought the sculpture at Clover Adams's gravesite showed not only consummate skill, but tremendous courage, stirring, as it did, no sense of hope, or an afterlife, or surcease of sorrow, as James remembered that hack Poe had once phrased it, but only the infinite depths of sorrow and loss. To St. Gaudens's right on the other side of the table were Clarence King, Dr. Granger, and Henry Cabot Lodge, to Hayes' left. All the men at the table seemed extraordinarily witty this night, but Kipling and Roosevelt stole the show as far as James's adrenaline and morphine-muddled perceptions could judge such things. The 27-year-old Kipling, who'd been wintering at their home in snowy Vermont and whose wife Carrie had just had a baby on December 29th, was the object of much congratulating and backslapping. James would someday write, "Kipling strikes me personally as the most complete man of genius, as distinct from fine intelligence, that I have ever known."
"It was very considerate of Josephine to choose 29 December as her birth date," the young writer was saying, "since my birthday is on the 30th and Carrie's on the 31st. Keeps things tidy, as it were."
Dr. Granger, his nose already reddening with drink, but his enunciation still perfect, asked if the addition of the baby helped them stay warm up in what the Kiplings had named Bliss Cottage near Brattleboro.
"The dear babe is not big enough to offer much in the way of supportive body heat," laughed Kipling, "but the exercise of walking back and forth with her on the nights she cries has been very helpful in keeping warm."
The conversation kept shifting, but James could not stop his mind from wandering back to the incredible events of the day and his still urgent need to get in touch with Sherlock Holmes. Kipling and Roosevelt were queried about their beloved Cosmos Club that sat right across Lafayette Park from Hayes' home, combining the Talo House with the Dolly Madison home. Both Kipling and Roosevelt were fanatical about the out-of-doors, and the Cosmos Club, besides being perhaps the most elite and influential men's club in America, reflected their passions.
"We did start this little organization called the National Geographic Society there 5 years ago," said Teddy Roosevelt.
Kipling began laughing himself, and when queried, said,
"Forgive me, but I remember when friend Theodore first presented himself to the club with thoughts of joining. 20 of the older members set out several hundred random fossil bones on a table in the main dining room and asked Theodore to identify any of them if he could."
"Could he?"
asked Clarence King, obviously very well knowing the answer and already grinning. Kipling laughed again. James thought it was a pleasant laugh, manly and rich, but never caustic at anyone else's expense.
"For the next several hours, Theodore proceeded not only to identify the fossil bones, but to separate them into the various living and extinct animals they each represented. He did everything but wire them together, gentlemen, all the while giving a running commentary on the eating, grazing, predatory, and breeding habits of each animal."
"Teddy's been a star member of the Cosmos Club ever since," said Hay, ignoring Roosevelt's scowl at the use of his childhood name. Others offered various anecdotes on various topics, even James, but before they'd opened the fourth bottle for the table, Kipling was begging Roosevelt to tell his story about the grizzly in the bushes out in Dakota. Roosevelt grinned and did so. He kept the story short, with just the right amount of detail, but Henry James found it especially humorous. The huge grizzly, it seemed, was old and myopic, almost blind. Roosevelt had lost his glasses during a fast descent on a steep, wooded hillside, so he ended up almost as blind as the bear. His first shot missed.
"I missed the heart, but caught him in the backside," said Roosevelt,
following the true raconteur's prime rule of never smiling or laughing at his own tale.
"The bear went into a thick mass of high willow bushes, almost too close together for me to push into, and, especially without my glasses, I found myself none too eager to force my way into those bushes, where Mr. Grizzly and I could have met up in an instant, long before I could raise my rifle, and the animal was not in the best of moods that morning."
Eventually, Roosevelt did get into the bushes to distract the animal. After an hour of trying to lure him out, he finally thwacked his way into the willows using the barrel of his Winchester to clear his way and with a huge Bowie knife in his teeth. That image alone made the others at the table laugh, and James laughed along with them.
"The blind stalking the blind," said Roosevelt, "and in the end, so to speak, the bear was blinder, or I was luckier."
James enjoyed the anecdote, and had no doubt that it was true, but it reminded him that none of them, King, Roosevelt, or him, had mentioned the street brawl with the would-be street thieves just 40 minutes earlier. Henry James did not know the etiquette involved in discussing violent street fights. Perhaps a gentleman was not supposed to mention it if he came out on the winning side. Or perhaps King and Roosevelt wanted to save James from embarrassment, the same way they had saved him from what certainly would have been a severe beating, if not stabbing, and violent robbery less than an hour earlier. James made a mental note to have his protagonist behave precisely this way if he went straight to a fine dinner with friends directly after such a violent altercation. But, James admitted to himself, he doubted if any of his characters would ever have such a violent encounter. The conversation was turning to current events, but Henry James's thoughts kept orbiting his afternoon and what seemed the absolute imperative of telling someone in authority about Professor Moriarty's plans for presidential assassination, the uprising of the anarchists, and mob warfare. The other men were discussing finances, especially the much ballyhooed but never quite arrived Panic of 93, and this gave James a perfect opportunity to become lost in his own thoughts without seeming rude. Everyone at the table, save perhaps for Teddy Roosevelt, knew that Henry James was a writer. He had no finances. One was delightfully liberated from endless male chatter about investments when one could not afford a single investment.
"If I don't hear from Holmes," James was thinking, "perhaps I should go to Washington's major and superintendent of police, or perhaps to President Cleveland himself."
That last thought made him cringe. It would be possible. Several of his friends at this table, Hay, Cabot Lodge, perhaps young Roosevelt, had dined with the president several times, maybe even Adams, who frowned on knowing all recent presidents. James might have an emergency meeting arranged for as soon as tomorrow morning.
"To say what?" he thought. "To report that while I was hiding out in the rafters of a former chicken slaughterhouse, I happened to hear Professor James Moriarty, who is considered a fictional character by most people, even possibly, most probably, his nemesis, Sherlock Holmes, planning to assassinate the President of the United States and 10 or more other heads of states, and perhaps scores of top government officials in America and almost a dozen European nations, and not only carry out these assassinations, but simultaneously instigate anarchist uprisings and gang riots in all these scores of cities, here and abroad."
"It can be traced back to the failure of the wheat crop on the Buenos Aires exchange,"
Cabot Lodge was saying. Hay waved that supposition away. They were all smoking cigars now, save for Roosevelt, Dr. Granger, and James.
"It's the railroad speculation, pure and simple," said Hay. "Whatever it is or was or will be, you business types were talking about the panic of 93 as long ago as November of 92. Something had better arrive soon, or a lot of speculators selling short will be very disappointed."
Was this the renowned Sherlock Holmes's plan? To grab President Grover Cleveland's massive arm and pull him away from the button that would start every machine at the Columbian Exposition a few seconds after noon on May 1st, tugging down the huge president and crying, "Get down, you fool!" the way that young Captain Oliver Wendell Holmes was supposed to have done with President Lincoln at Fort Stevens in 1864? James doubted that.
"There was a clear prelude to panic in February when the Philadelphia and Reading Railroad went bankrupt by overextending itself,"
said Cabot Lodge. "I thought Cleveland handled the Treasury crisis rather handily," said Hay, "by convincing Congress to repeal the Sherman Silver Purchase Act just days after his inauguration."
For a Democrat, the only one elected president in my living memory, Cleveland does seem to be a man of action, said Dr. Granger.
He could have taken on my grizzly barehanded, said Roosevelt. They would have weighed in the same before the bout.
Now, Theodore, said Henry Adams.
I can't delay leaving tomorrow, thought James. If I stay, I'll never see the end of these conspiracies or complications. There's simply no other choice but to get word of Professor Moriarty's meeting with the gangs and the anarchists, and to repeat what the... What had the Times of London called him after Reichenbach Falls? The Napoleon of Crime had said about the planned assassinations, uprisings, and lootings. I've been caught up in one of the romance adventure novels I so despise. Something less even than H. Rider Haggard's overly violent, overly specific potboilers. And the only way I can escape it is to walk away from everything I've seen and heard today. Everything I've seen and heard the last few weeks since the Seine. That way lies reality. Or at least literature. Anything is better than this penny dreadful tale I've found myself in.
The free silver movement is the wild card in this game, said Hay, especially with the American farmers supporting it.
If people and failing banks start demanding gold for their notes,
Henry Adams said as if he were thinking aloud.
In the West and Midwest, more than 300 banks have already closed, said Roosevelt.
In the West and Midwest, said Hay, gesturing to his servant to pass a new bottle of wine around. Anyone with two barrels, a plank, and a cigar box full of quarters can declare themselves a bank.
I have to leave tomorrow, thought James with a sudden pain in his chest and left arm. I must leave tomorrow. Buy a garden trowel along the way, so I can bury the snuff box with Alice's ashes securely inside it. I was tempted to go to Newport, where she and Miss Loring seemed so happy after Alice had the house on the point built for them. But I think Catherine Loring has had just about enough of Alice's company. No, my dear, darling, caustic, death-desiring Alice needs to lie in the same soil as our parents and Aunt Kate. And then I have to rush to make that noon train to New York. I can't miss that German steamship's... The Spray, wasn't it? Departure time on Tuesday morning. Once aboard, I can relax, I can think, I can take the time and energy to sort out what has been reality and what illusion over these past weeks. Mr. Sherlock Holmes will simply have to fend for himself in this multifaceted mess of a mystery. One thing is certain. I'll never be his adoring Boswell the way Dr. Watson is. If he is a real person, or if he's a product of Conan Doyle's literary imagination, faithfully chronicling the detective's triumphs, it's a poverty of triumphs I've seen him produce.
A servant slipped in with a slip of paper on a silver tray. The young man whispered to Hay, who nodded and gestured toward James. It was a telegram. James could not wait until later to open it. It had to be Holmes's response to his news about Moriarty and his urgent plea. So he slid it open and read it as he held it below the plane of the table. The telegram was moderately succinct.
James, if it is convenient for you, please meet me on Monday at 3 p.m. at 436 and a half Revere Street in Beacon Hill, Boston. Stop. If it is not convenient for you, still meet me there at that time. Stop. You may leave your luggage at the new North Union Station on Causeway Street in the West End, since we shall be taking a night train west to Chicago that same evening. Stop. Holmes.
16. God might envy him. Sherlock Holmes rang Henry Adams's newfangled electrical doorbell button in late morning, about an hour after James's train had left for New York and then Boston. The tall head butler, Hobson, answered the door and seemed no happier to see Holmes than he'd been during their last encounter.
"Mr. Adams is still in his bath," said Hobson, making ready to close the door in Holmes's face.
"That's all right,"
said Holmes, handing his hat and stick to the tall man as he brushed past him.
I shall be happy to wait for Mr. Adams in his study.
While the flustered Hobson sought out his bathing master, Holmes stepped into the study, poured himself a healthy dose of scotch with a whisper of water, and sprawled in the chair opposite the infinite expanse of Adams's green leather desktop. He lined up two fingers in a straight line with the executive mansion window of what had once been the office of President Cleveland's sister, before she had been replaced by a 21-year-old bride, Miss Frances Folsom. Since Cleveland was 49 on the day of the marriage, the public might have been shocked by the more than 27-year age difference, or, failing that, disconcerted a bit by the fact that his marriage was unusual, since Cleveland had been the executor of his friend and Frances's father, Oscar Folsom's estate, supervising Frances's upbringing after her father's death. He'd bought her yellow baby carriage when she was a few days old, and he still seemed to be giving her bright things. Holmes had met with the Steamboat Inspection Committee that Sunday morning, minus former major and superintendent of the Metropolitan Police, William G. Brock, though his place was filled by Chief Daniel O'Malley, head of the 27-man White House police force. And while Mr. Rockhill, the State Department liaison, was complaining that he had to miss church, Holmes was asking Vice President Adlai E. Stevenson where he planned to be on May 1st, around noon, just about the time President Cleveland was scheduled to push the button that started everything at the Chicago World's Columbian Exposition. Vice President Stevenson had to think a minute and then refer to a pocket record keeper, but finally he said, "Oh, I'll be in the executive mansion from 10:30 a.m. until mid-afternoon, meeting and lunching with delegates from the current regime in the Philippines, and then taking part in a formal signing of a letter of agreement with them."
"Where will the meeting and signing take place, Mr. Vice President?" asked Holmes.
Stevenson had to think about that for a minute, but then remembered.
"Oh, that will be in what we now call the small treaty room."
"Would that happen to be the north-facing room, whose window one can see directly across the park there? The one directly across from Mr. Henry Adams's home?" asked Holmes. "The room that was President Cleveland's sister's office and reception room during Mr. Cleveland's first term?"
"Why, yes, I believe that's the same room," said Vice President Stevenson. Holmes turned to Mr. Drummond, the highly intelligent chief of the Secret Service branch of the Treasury Department, and to Daniel O'Malley. O'Malley had not struck Holmes as especially bright during the short time he'd been conversing with him that morning.
"We have reliable indications that an attempt will be made upon Vice President Stevenson's life at or around the same time that the president is scheduled to be assassinated in Chicago. The small treaty room is in a direct line to various windows in Mr. Henry Adams's home, less than 200 yards to the north.
Shall we request permission for the event to be moved to another room?" asked Chief O'Malley.
"I would suggest that you keep the Vice President and his guests out of the White House for all of that day," said Holmes. "Perhaps choose an inside room at the State Department and make sure that the change of venue and location remains a tightly held secret."
Drummond of the Secret Service nodded, and Holmes knew that it would be done.
"You see how someone could use a good rifle to make a clear shot into the small treaty room from one of the windows on the Adams's home?" asked Holmes, pointing.
"Mr. Adams would never allow that," said White House Police Chief O'Malley.
"Next to Adams's house is the home of Colonel John Hay,"
Washington PD Major and Superintendent Moore informed Holmes.
"We can't be bothering such important people just because of their proximity to the executive mansion."
"Of course not," said Sherlock Holmes.
"I'll look into it and talk to you in the next week," said Andrew Drummond.
Holmes understood that to mean that the Adams's house would be thoroughly searched, the best shooting angles analyzed by marksmen, and that the head of the Secret Service, a department with no constitutional responsibilities to protect the president, would have men there on May 1st.
"Chief O'Malley," said Holmes,
Are you still detaching two of your White House police to travel with the president, as is sometimes the custom?
Said O'Malley, and looked around the room as if someone could give him the correct answer.
I could send more men, or less men.
Fewer, corrected Holmes.
He had the same reaction to hearing the English language abused as he did to watching horses or dogs beaten with no reason, and he was not especially a sentimentalist when it came to horses or dogs. But he had once told Watson that the less or fewer issue, along with the use of I in such sentences as, he gave the money to Sheila and I, inflicted on the public by people who considered themselves well-educated, could be drastically reduced in frequency, if not actually abolished, by a few well-aimed pistol shots and an explanatory note that would be pinned to the victim's chests.
"Think I should send less than the usual two?" asked Chief O'Malley.
Here, Vice President Stevenson stepped in with what might have been the briefest of winks at Holmes.
"We know there's a threat against the White House, Chief O'Malley, and Colonel Sebastian Moran is a famed marksman and soldier of fortune, as opposed to these phantoms that the others are looking for. It might be wisest to retain all 27 of your excellent roster of White House police officers on that day. After all, you were trained to protect the executive mansion from intrusion, not follow the president around to protect him."
"True," said O'Malley. "And it's the Chicago Police Department's job to protect the president. The host city always assumes that responsibility."
"Only partially the responsibility of the Chicago PD, said the Secret Service chief.
Holmes looked at Drummond. No one else had brought this up at any of their meetings.
"What do you mean?"
asked Washington's major and Superintendent Moore. In a private moment before the group assembled, Holmes had asked Drummond if he thought that Chicago had the honor of hosting the most corrupt police department in the country. Finally, Chief Drummond had nodded.
"Now that the last of the Tweed Ring is out of New York, and the new corruptors haven't yet taken their place, Chicago is the most corrupt. It runs in their veins like the booze they consume. But there are good men on the force there, and very few out of the hundreds who'd aid and abet in the murder of a president."
Holmes had nodded. Now Chief O'Malley said loudly,
"What do you mean when you say that the Chicago Police Department won't be responsible for President Cleveland's safety?"
"From the door of the Lexington Hotel until he reaches the exposition grounds, the so-called White City down in Jackson Park, the CPD will be the responsible agency," said Holmes. "But once the procession enters the sacrosanct grounds of the World's Columbian Exposition, the group directly responsible for the safety of the President of the United States, not to mention the 40 or 50 other dignitaries there that day, President of Brazil, I'm told, being the people's favorite, shifts to the Colombian Guard."
"What the hell is the Colombian Guard?" asked O'Malley.
Drummond answered, "It's the private police force that Daniel Burnham put together, just for the World's Fair."
"No Chicago police?" said Moore.
"None," said Secret Service Chief Drummond. "On the fairgrounds, the Colombian Guard have the power to detain, interrogate, and arrest. There's a nice little Colombian Guard jail just off the Midway Plaisance, but mostly, of course, they will be rounding up lost children, giving directions, intervening before private drunkenness becomes a public problem, and being courteous to hundreds of thousands of customers who've come to the exposition to have a wonderful time." "How many of these Colombian guardsmen are there?" asked Vice President Stevenson.
Holmes answered, "Just over 2,000, Mr. Vice President."
2,000?
Exploded Washington PD Major and Superintendent Moore.
"That's an army!"
"That, I believe," said Holmes, "was Daniel Burnham's intention. The so-called White City will be electrified far beyond the current dreams of Chicago, New York, Washington, or any other major American city. Pleasant streetlights and glowing electrical lanterns and radiant storefronts and searchlights and lighting from huge windows and path lights illuminating more than 600 acres of World's Fairgrounds, combined with the highest percentage of trained police officers, uniformed and plain clothes alike, to the number of citizens, will make the White City the safest urban environment in the world.
As long as it's safe for President Cleveland during the hours he shall be there, said Vice President Stevenson.
What kind of weapons do these Colombian guardsmen carry?
Asked Moore. Holmes smiled. Most of them carry a whistle and a short sword in a scabbard.
Henry Adams came into his study, wearing his dressing gown and slippers. He frowned at the detective, who remained seated.
I see you've made yourself comfortably at home, Mr. Holmes.
Holmes smiled and nodded.
And no doubt taken the time to ransack my drawers and cabinets.
Only to the extent of pouring myself a drink for the long wait, Mr. Adams. An excellent whiskey.
I hadn't planned on ever seeing you again, said Adams.
Holmes nodded. Adams went around to his side of the desk, hesitating as if debating whether he would acknowledge Holmes's presence more by sitting or by standing. He sat.
I thought that I had made it abundantly clear at our last meeting, Mr. Holmes, said Adams, that it was our last meeting, that we have nothing more to discuss, either in public or private.
Holmes removed one of the small "She Was Murdered" cards from his pocket and set it on Adams's green leather desk blotter.
This has nothing to do with me, said Adams.
He tore the card into shreds and dropped them into his wastebasket.
Ned Hooper hired me to find out who was sending out these cards to you and survivors of the Five Hearts each year. And since he's now also dead, you were the closest relative, through your late wife, to whom I could report, said Holmes.
By your own admission, said Adams, you met my wife's late brother for less than an hour some 2 years ago. That hardly gives you the right, Mr. Holmes, to call Edward Ned, as his family and friends did. If you must refer to him, you may use Mr. Fowler.
Holmes nodded.
I was paid by Mr. Fowler to use my skills to discover who was sending these cards, and also, in his very words, to see if Clover actually died by her own hand or by some means more sinister. So in Mr. Fowler's absence, I shall report to you.
Adams had turned his face toward the windows, but now he shot a glance at Holmes.
You know who's been sending those cards the last 7 years?
Yes.
A charred log collapsed in Adams's small fireplace. Even on warming spring days, he evidently kept a small fire burning in his study. Holmes wondered if the widower historian suffered from a permanent chill. After a stretch of silence, Adams snapped,
Well, are you going to tell me or not?
No,
said Holmes. Henry Adams's face flushed, even while his lips grew whiter.
You said that because your client, Ned, took his own life in December, you were duty-bound to report to me. Now you say you won't tell me the identity of this person who has been hounding and harassing the four of us these past 6 years? Such insolence! If I were a few years younger, Mr. Holmes...
Holmes nodded, as if he could see such a prospect as scholarly Henry Adams giving the detective a beating.
I've deduced who the person is who typed and sent those cards, he said. But I require a private, personal interview with that person. Such an interview isn't possible right now, but will be carried out by the first week in May.
In other words, spat Adams, you're guessing.
I never guess, said Sherlock Holmes.
He steepled his long, pale fingers under his chin, and his gaze seemed fixed on something very far away. His expression, which so often seemed impassive when not in the throes of excitement or strong intellectual emotion, now looked stern. That sternness was not directed at Henry Adams, but it still made the historian uneasy.
I don't suppose you've discovered anything about the rest of this mystery of my poor wife's death, which was never a mystery,
said Adams. It had been a clumsy sentence, and Adams, the constant writer and consummate editor, frowned at it. Holmes seemed to return from wherever his thoughts had taken him.
Oh, yes, he said almost offhandedly. I've confirmed beyond doubt that Clover, Mrs. Adams, was murdered.
Adams's bearded jaw dropped, and although he quickly shut his mouth and attempted to control his expression, it was 30 seconds or more before he could speak.
Murdered?
How?
By whom? And for what possible reason?
I expect to have the answer to all three of your new questions before the fortnight is out, said Holmes.
As to the how, there is no doubt that her death resulted from the administration of arsenic from her own photographic developing liquids. But the question stays on the list because we're not certain of how that poison was administered.
So, in truth, you're still blindly guessing about everything, said Adams.
I never guess, sir.
Do you even have, what are they called in your cheap mystery tales? Suspects?
I know the murderer was one of three people, said Holmes, with your name being the third on that list of possibilities.
Me! Cried Adams, jumping to his feet. You have the insulting, insufferable.
Words failed him, and Adams reached for his walking stick propped behind him.
You had the time, the knowledge of, and access to the poison, and, as for motives, murders of a spouse always have the most complicated, personal, and opaque of motives, said Holmes. In this case, everyone around you knows that your wife had always had a melancholy streak. She herself had written letters home during your long honeymoon in Egypt and elsewhere, in which she admitted to her father that she'd been too overcome by my old nemesis of melancholy, was how she put it, I believe, even to speak to you, her new husband, or to anyone else for almost 2 weeks. Such melancholy, always hovering nearby over the years, grows wearing on a spouse, and you yourself have described how more deeply lost in unhealthy sadness she'd been for much of that last year after the death of her father, in March of 1885.
Henry Adams gritted his teeth so hard that the grinding of molars was louder than the cracklings of the fireplace. He lifted the heavy walking stick like a club, his knuckles white from the intensity of his grip. Holmes did not stir or try to protect himself as Henry Adams leaned over the desktop toward him, the cane raised and shaking from the man's fury. Holmes's own stick was propped against another chair some 6 feet away. He made no motion toward it, but remained seated, his eyes on Adams's face, his hands calmly folded on his lap. Adams dropped the cane onto the Persian carpet and collapsed into his chair, slumping down and shielding his eyes with one hand. After a moment, he said,
"You must know that I did not kill my beloved Clover."
"Oh, I know you did not," said Holmes, now resting his chin on his folded fingers, propping his elbows on the polished wooden arms of his chair. "But any competent police officer, much less a competent and ambitious district attorney, could have, and probably should have, since you are investigated so shallowly primarily due to your station in society and your wealth, ended with you condemned to the gallows by a jury of your peers."
Adams's jaw dropped again, and this time he did not soon think to close his mouth. He peered through his fingers at Holmes the way a child might peep through her fingers at a possible monster in a dark closet.
"You had the time. You knew where Mrs. Adams kept her deadly arsenic, and no servants on duty that morning saw you leave for this sudden Sunday morning appointment with your dentist. Since you never saw your dentist that morning, you could have been waiting half a block down the street, along the park's edge, waiting until you saw Rebecca Lorne come to your doorway. She was, in a sense, your alibi."
"If you think all this," rasped Adams, "then why do you not believe me to be guilty of this murder?"
Holmes walked over to the open secretary where the bottles were kept, replenished his Scotch whiskey, and poured a stiff drink of brandy for Adams, setting it in front of him on the desk rather than handing it to him.
"I know you are innocent not merely because of your obvious qualities," said Holmes, "but because you did not see Rebecca Lorne waiting at the front door of your home, pondering whether to knock and go up, as you testified to the police. Rather, you saw Miss Lorne come rushing out of your home, flinging the door wide in a state of near hysteria. It had been she, not you, who first discovered Mrs. Adams's body."
"How do you know that?"
demanded Adams, and took a long drink of brandy.
"You yourself ran 2 blocks to your doctor's home and returned on the run with him. And Dr. Charles E. Hagner later reported to the press that the vial of potassium cyanide sat, still opened and venting its terrible fumes, on a table across the room from where Mrs. Adams's body had fallen to the floor in front of her favorite chair, and that an empty water glass lay on the carpet beside her," said Holmes. "Dr. Hagner also mentioned that Miss Rebecca Lorne was waiting in the room adjoining Mrs. Adams's bedroom when the two of you arrived, and that Miss Lorne was so upset that he had to administer a tranquilizing drug to her. The police report, done under the investigation of Lieutenant Hammond, who arrived with 2 men some 20 minutes after you and Hagner did, but who remained only a few minutes before you demanded absolute isolation with your wife's body, mentioned the position of the body and the vial of cyanide, now corked again, but made no mention of the water glass on the carpet." "The scene is forever branded into my brain," said Adams, "but I remember no water glass on the floor." "The bottle of poison was on a table some distance from where Mrs. Adams had lain on the carpet before you carried her body to the couch," said Holmes, tapping his lips with 2 steepled forefingers. "All agree on that, and yet there had been a spill of the chemical near where your wife's body had been lying. Your housekeeper commented that the lethal liquid had discolored the edge of the carpet and a bit of the polished floor. Her people had cut the carpet's nap and refinished the floorboard to get rid of the stains," she said.
Adams's temples and cheeks grew flushed again.
"My housekeeper had the temerity to talk to you about—"
Holmes held up both hands, palms outward.
"There was not much of a police investigation, sir, but the servants did have to give statements to the police while you were in your darkest hours of mourning. I understand that you spent 2 days and nights alone with the body and did not later announce the time or fact of Mrs. Adams's funeral on December 9, so your surviving 3 Hearts friends could attend. At any rate, this information about the stained carpet and floorboard were in Lieutenant Hammond's notes."
"What's the importance of any of this?" shouted Adams.
"There was, lying near Mrs. Adams's body, a water glass that had obviously been the vessel from which she drank the poison, still lying there when Dr. Hagner arrived with you," said Holmes. "The stains on the carpet and floorboard must have come from the residue of the terrible liquid that remained in the glass when Mrs. Adams dropped it. Yet the glass was gone when Detective Hammond arrived about 30 minutes later."
Holmes leaned forward, his gray eyes as piercing as a predator's. "Someone removed that glass in that 30-minute interim," he said softly. "Your housekeeper, Mrs. Soames, told the police 3 days after the death that there were only 11 small water glasses in the cupboard off the kitchen, where they were usually kept. The glass had come from a set of 12. Adams finished the brandy.
"Who, if not the servants, who would have removed the glass? The mythical glass I do not even remember seeing. The police?"
"They say they did not, sir."
I don't understand the significance of a water glass or the vial of cyanide," managed Adams. "Why does it make any difference?"
"It would be easier to make someone drink from the glass than from a vial," Holmes said.
Adams's dark eyes seemed to recede in their sockets.
"Make them drink?
Someone might have forced Clover to drink that terrible, corrosive, painful, deadly poison?
Yes, said Holmes. More than that, there is the time involved. Were there usually water glasses left in her bedroom?
No, said Adams, his voice totally flat. Clover hated rings on the furniture.
In the adjoining bathroom?
No, repeated Adams. There are glasses in our bathrooms, but not those small water glasses. And Clover's was still there when I looked in her bathroom some days later.
From the time you left to see your dentist to the time you turned around and came back because of the commotion Miss Lorne was making as she came out of your front door, began Holmes, and noticed when Adams did not interrupt or contradict him, it would have been very difficult for Mrs. Adams to go downstairs through the annex to the kitchen where the water glasses were stored, and to avoid being noticed by Mrs. Ryan, your chief cook, who was working in the kitchen at the time, and then to carry it upstairs and then to walk the length of the second floor to her darkroom and the special locked cupboard where she kept her photographic developing chemicals, then to return to her bedroom to take the poison.
Adams shook his head like a man in a bad dream.
You're suggesting that someone else had carried up the glass and poison vial and was waiting somewhere upstairs, hiding nearby, listening, waiting for her to be alone, even while I was talking to Clover, before I left to see my dentist?
It is a distinct possibility, said Holmes.
And it must have been Rebecca Lorne, whom Clover liked and trusted, and who I also relied upon in the days after... After...
rasped Adams.
It would have to be Rebecca Lorne, because she would have been the only one who could have taken the glass between the visits of the doctor and the police lieutenant.
She almost certainly took the glass away with her, said Holmes. But she is not the only suspect, if it was murder rather than suicide. There is another.
Adams stared so hard at Holmes that the detective felt almost burned by the historian's gaze.
Clifton Richards, Miss Lorne's cousin, may have been involved, said Holmes. He may have been in the house and gone down the back way, the servant's stairs, and out of the house, even as Rebecca Lorne rushed up the main stairway to warn Mrs. Adams.
To warn her,
Adams repeated dully. He managed to focus his eyes on Holmes's face.
Who killed my wife, Mr. Holmes?
I beg of you, if you know, tell me.
I'll know for a certainty in the next few weeks, Mr. Adams, which is why I need to ask a favor of you.
Adams may have nodded an infinitesimal bit.
I've convinced John Hay and Cabot Lodge to move the visit to the Chicago World's Fair up a couple of weeks for the actual opening on May 1st, arriving in his private car perhaps a day or two early, said Holmes. And Senator Cameron has his private yacht, the Great Lakes Yacht, I believe they call it, ready to anchor just off the pier of the exposition.
Going to the wretched exposition will help reveal my Clover's murderer and bring him or her to justice, said Adams.
Yes.
Then I'll go along with Cameron, Hay, the Lodges, and the rest. Although I saw the Philadelphia World's Fair, and it was a monumental bore.
Holmes actually smiled. As he prepared to leave, Adams gripped his arm and said,
But why would they kill Clover? Why would anyone want to harm that witty, sad, lonely, darling woman?
Holmes settled back into his seat, sighed, and reached into his upper inside jacket pocket to pull out a small blue envelope still tied in pink ribbon. It had been opened. Holmes removed the handwritten letter and held it so that Adams could put on his glasses and read it across the wide desk. Henry Adams read his own handwriting for half a moment, and then let out an inarticulate noise and lunged for the letter.
No, said Holmes, folding it and putting it back into his jacket pocket.
I can't allow you to tear this up the way you did the card earlier.
That's my property, snarled the small historian.
Holmes nodded.
Legally, it is, sir, even though it was in the possession of another person. Why would Lizzie, how did you, why would she give you that most intimate of letters? My greatest folly?
She didn't give it to me, said Holmes. She doesn't know I have it. I had to borrow it. When my investigations are done, I shall return it to where she kept it hidden.
Investigations, hissed Adams in contempt. Reading other people's most private mail. Sneaking into boudoirs in the night. Stealing.
I assure you that I shall return it in the next few weeks, said Holmes. Mrs. Cameron shall never know that I had taken the letter from its hiding place. I simply needed to know for sure what Rebecca Lorne and the so-called Clifton Richards were using to blackmail Mrs. Adams.
Blackmail?
It sounded as if Henry Adams were going to start laughing wildly.
Then I did kill Clover Adams. I was the cause, Alpha and Omega, of my darling's death.
No, said Holmes. It was my duty in solving this case to find and read this letter, Mr. Adams. But I assure you that I took no pleasure in doing so. And I found no evil there. It was a note from a terribly sad man, who had been essentially abandoned by a wife, lost to melancholy, not merely in the previous months, but for years. A midnight love letter to another woman, one he knew well and admired much. It was folly, Mr. Adams, but exquisitely human and understandable folly.
We went to the Cameron's house on the evening of December 4th,
said Adams, speaking as if mesmerized, his eyes unfocused.
2 days before Clover, before her death. Lizzie Cameron had been ill, and Clover had been unusually distraught about the illness. She knew, we all knew, that a major source of Lizzie's illness lay in the travesty of her marriage to Don. Clover felt bad about that as well. That night we took Rebecca Lorne with us. It was warm, I remember, not feeling like December at all. To cheer Lizzie up, Clover had brought along a large bouquet of yellow Maracal Neal roses, not easy to find in December in Washington, and she and Rebecca took the roses up to Lizzie's sick room. Do you know the language of flowers, Mr. Holmes?
Only bits of it. Adams smiled with no humor. In the language of flowers so popular these days, the yellow roses signified, I'm yours, heart and soul. This is what she gave Lizzie Cameron less than 48 hours before her death.
She was giving that message to you, Holmes said softly.
Adams shook his head.
If Clover knew about my mad, impulsive letter to Lizzie of the previous July. That letter,
he pointed at Holmes's breast pocket,
and begged to know if it was true. If Rebecca Lorne had tantalized her with the knowledge of that letter, or even of the possibility of its existence, and if Lizzie did not deny it.
Holmes reached across the desk and touched Adams's forearm, squeezing it very softly.
Don't let your imagination run away with you, Adams. You know Clover's good heart. Her flower language expressions to her sick friend were almost certainly just that, an act of love and generosity.
But Holmes knew that there had been a confrontation of sorts over the letter from Henry Adams that night. Clover had asked Lizzie Cameron if it was true, if such a letter from My Henry existed. Lizzie had been sick and in a foul mood, and while ridiculing the entire idea, had also gone out of her way not to deny. She even teased Clover and Rebecca Lorne for wanting to see such a curious document. Holmes knew all this because, besides liberating that letter from Lizzie Cameron's hiding place of letters taped to the bottom of her dresser drawer, he'd also borrowed her private 1885 diary long enough to read entries from the first week of December. The diary had been put back in place, at some risk to Holmes's agent in these matters. But he would keep the July letter and other letters taken from other homes by the same dirty means until events of the next few weeks were settled. Holmes could see and feel Adams approaching his personal breaking point. This was the man who, after his wife's death, had fled to the South Seas with an artist friend for 3 years and more than 30,000 miles of aimless wandering. This was the man who had sworn the great sculptor St. Gaudens to secrecy and then had him build that mausoleum for the living inside the extraordinary memorial not to his wife's memory, but to the memory of his own grief. Standing, his hat and cane in hand, Holmes paused and removed another slip of paper from his jacket.
Hay gave me this, although all your friends know it, Adams. Clover, Mrs. Adams, began a letter to her sister Ellen shortly after you left that Sunday morning to visit your dentist. I know you remember the words, but it might help find perspective to hear them again. If I had one single point of character or goodness, I would stand on that and grow back to life. Henry is more patient and loving than words can express. God might envy him. He bears and hopes and despairs hour after hour. Henry is beyond all words, tenderer and better than all of you, even.
Holmes folded the note and set it away next to the blue paper letter.
She wrote that note, Mr. Adams, after she had learned of the possible existence of your July letter to Lizzie Cameron. She had already forgiven you.
Adams stood and turned his unfathomable gaze toward the detective.
When must I see you next, Mr. Holmes? What new hell awaits me? All of us. Chicago, said Holmes.
He let himself out quietly, without calling for Hobson the butler.